Hey, this is Waylon Payne, and you are listening to Walking the Floor with Chris Shiflett.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett. Welcome to episode number 182 of Walking the Floor. For reasons I will get to in a moment, I had the strange experience this past week of actually going and sifting through some of the emails that I get to my Walking the Floor specific email account that I created years ago, so that when you go to the Walking the Floor website and click on contact, it goes to this email account that, to be perfectly honest, I never fucking read. And so there's like thousands of emails in this account. And I started sifting through them this week. And of course, as you would expect, most of it is like spam. And then there's a lot of like, you know, people saying things like, could you get Dave Grohl to officiate my wedding? And, you know, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of that. Send me an autographed guitar pick, you know, those kinds of emails. And then like requests from people for like, could you interview this person? Could you interview that person? There's some people like, hey man, I recorded this song. I want to come on your show. There's like all kinds of stuff. But you know what was on there maybe more than anything else? People asking me who the singer in the Walking the Floor theme is, who the second singer is. You know, Merle Haggard's in there, Ernest Tubbs in there, but the second singer, people go, who is that? I can't put my finger on it. I haven't even listened to the theme of this show in a very long time. So I had to go back and listen to it. And you know what the craziest part is? I have no idea. I don't even know where I have the audio file where I compiled that thing, but I gotta look that up because there are a lot of people out there asking, who is the second singer in the Walking the Floor theme? It remains a mystery. If you know, why don't you tweet it at me? Because that'd be a lot easier than me, like, you know, powering up old computers and searching through files that are all dusty and who knows? Who knows where it is? Anyway, yeah, we'll see if we can get to the bottom of that. The reason I was looking through those Gmail accounts was actually because I had a very, for me was a strange experience of getting kind of called on the carpet and some accusations made by a person who, this was on my Twitter feed, and it's a person who has an Apple Radio show that whose show I wasn't familiar with, but from what I gather is very tied into the LGBT communities of country music and Americana. And this person was calling me out for not being inclusive enough with my podcast. And so that sort of spurred some different things. We had a back and forth. It turned into what I thought was kind of, I mean, I was trying to be respectful and just sort of explain myself. But then you get, well, here, you judge for yourself. And feel free to fast forward this if you're like, I don't give a fuck, man. Just get on with your show. I just feel a certain responsibility to address it because there was a lot of stuff going on my Twitter feed. But this was the initial tweet from this person. It said, Chris Shiflett, out of the 100 most recent episodes of Walking the Floor, I counted a mere 4 LGBTQ artists and only 2 BIPOC. 2 out of 100. In all caps, fire your talent booker. Okay. So that prompted me to respond. You know, when you get accusations that you think are unfair, I think it's kind of a normal reaction to respond to them. And I let this person know, well, I'm the talent booker, so I can't really fire my talent booker. And went into some stuff about, you know, sort of the things that go into booking a show. And I will tell you as the listener that I have never discriminated against anybody as far as who the guests are on the show. But this has mostly been a one-man operation. You know, it's just me, you know, doing the interviews and editing it and posting it and promoting it and all that sort of thing. And it's very much a part-time passion project for me. I don't really run it like a serious business or anything. I've never really, well, I'll tell you, when I started
the podcast, it was really started to promote an album that I had coming out back in, I think, 2013. That was really, if there was ever an agenda attached to this thing, that was it, to promote an album and sort of use the podcast to promote an album. And then along the way, you know, I figured out I really enjoyed doing the interviews. And when I was first starting out, it was really a question of just, you know, I just needed to figure out who I could interview. I didn't know anything about booking interviews or how that whole process works. And podcasts were pretty new too. So the whole thing was kind of a mystery that I just figured out. And a lot of it was like people I knew or people that I could get a hold of. I think I got John Doe's phone number from somebody and just cold called him and asked if I could interview him. And so that was kind of the initial version of it. And then as we went along, or as things went along, I got to know a lot of publicists and managers that work in the world of Americana and country music. And that was always been mostly the focus, not exclusively, but mostly the focus. And so I got to know a lot of those folks. And over the course of getting to know them, you know, they started pitching me their artists and we started getting kind of established. And in the early days, I would take just about anybody that was offered to me, you know, in the hopes of sort of developing relationships with these folks who represent these people. Never gave a whole lot of thought to, you know, racial or gender or sexual identity or sexual preferences or any of that sort of thing. And along the way, have interviewed a lot of different people, you know, from this world of Americana and country music that is, you know, somewhat diverse, maybe not as diverse. I think it's fair to say that country music isn't necessarily as diverse as other genres are, and maybe that's changing. I don't know. I'm not super involved in the world of mainstream country music, but then at a certain point, you know, you have to keep in mind there are other factors like my schedule or the schedule of the people that I'm trying to interview. And also, you know, at a certain point you start being a little more selective about who you take, and other factors come into it. Like, does this guest have a fan base? You know, is this going to get ears on my podcast? Are they going to help promote the episode? You know, do I need to interview two lesser known artists to get to the bigger artist that this publicist reps? You know, there are considerations like that come into it. And it's not like my podcast isn't an open mic night. There is a barrier of entry. Like, there's a barrier of entry into everything in this business. And I can tell you, as a solo artist, I mean, obviously I'm in the Foo Fighters and that's a big band and we do very well and have a lot of opportunities. But as a solo artist, you know, I make records that are basically commercially irrelevant. And because of that, I don't get invited on the big podcasts, and I don't get never been on big Spotify playlists or get big support slot tours or you know, get you know, the top end media exposure or anything like that. And as much as I would like all those things to be true, I would love to have those opportunities, but you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I have no illusions about how this industry works. And I know that the reason that you don't hear me on Mark Maron or Joe Rogan is because I don't mean anything commercially to those outlets. And that's why I don't get booked on them. You know, maybe someday I'll write a song that connects with the public on a bigger level or something. Who knows? You know, I don't know. And if I ever do, you know, I might get those opportunities as well. But I don't get them now because I'm fucking meaningless to those outlets. And that really is just you know, how this industry or any industry works, really. But anyway, you know, I responded to this initial tweet and it came to my attention that the person that I was having this back and forth with actually went to their Facebook page and kind of rallied the troops to come get me. And come get me, they did. They came and got me. And all these crazy accusations started getting thrown at me, like, your podcast guest lineup looks like a KKK meeting, and you don't think it's important to include a little diversity, like, at all? Let's see, another one. I think this was the same person. Mob mentality. Yeah, sure, being told you're racist by lots of people is the same as being bullied. Or, Maybe if you included BIPOC and LGBT performers more often, they'd feel comfortable contacting you, but they're not going to pursue you if you look like a jackass. Now, that one I thought was kind of funny, because if you know anything about publicists in the music biz, you know these people are, you know, nothing against publicists, but they are not shy to pitch their artists. Then there was another one that was said, or you could question yourself and ask, can I do better? And that's really interesting, because I talked to a lot of people that I know in this business this past week about this very issue. And I was advised by several of them who told me things like, because they know this person that initiated these accusations against my show. And they described this person as, they said, well, she's really passionate about her issues. I thought that was... to me, that's really dangerous, you know, that gets written off as just being passionate instead of what it is, what I think it really is, which is much more aggressive than that. And I was also advised to say something like, well, you know, I'll try harder, or I'll do better, or whatever. But I didn't really want to do that, because that feels like an admission of guilt. And I don't feel that I've done anything wrong with my podcast. And it's sort of, I mean, there's the bigger question is, do I have a certain responsibility beyond just, to not negatively impact, you know, these communities? I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't feel like I have a greater responsibility to anybody else's agenda. I mean, from time to time, I do use my podcast to express my own political views. I have certain guests on that express, you know, political views that I want highlighted. And in some way, we all have agendas that we're pushing, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I'm out front on LGBTQ issues, or, you know, the issues that face communities of color and in the music industry or anything. Although I do think that I stand in solidarity with them and do not do any harm. So, do I have a responsibility beyond that? I don't know. Do I need to apologize for how I've run the show up to now? I just don't feel like I do. And that leads me to another comment that came through on my Twitter, which was, you sure spent a lot of energy defending yourself. And folks, if I sound defensive right now, I guess I am. Because I think it's important to defend yourself against these kind of attacks. It's wild. I've never been, had this, you know, kind of thing happen on my Twitter feed. Like the angry Twitter mob, the woke angry Twitter mob come after me. And it's a strange experience, I can tell you, because there is no amount of explaining that you can do that isn't spliced and diced and parsed and taken out of context and then thrown back in your face and used against you. And then once they get done with that, they start sticking words in your mouth and saying that you're saying things that you never said and thoughts that you never had and beliefs that you never pushed. And I think it's a big part of why there's such an outsized fear of people like this Apple Radio DJ in the entertainment industry. And that is the truth, man. If I can tell you that a lot of people told me, don't kick that beehive. Just don't kick that beehive, man. It's not worth it. But I feel like you have to stand up for yourself here. There's a couple things that I saw that this person then went and posted. I thought this one was particularly insane. It says, turns out attacking, in quotes, a straight, white, incredibly privileged rock star dude by respectfully pointing out the lack of diversity among his podcast guests and subsequently defending yourself when he sicks his fans on you is an incredibly stressful way to spend a day, and it has made my neck flare up pretty badly. Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. I don't believe this person respectfully pointed out my lack of diversity. I think this was an attack. And at no point, and you can go read the Twitter feed for yourself, at no point did I ever sick my fans on this person. And by the way, since we're on that point of things, I would like to strongly encourage anybody listening to this, do not respond in any way. Do not defend me. Don't go after this person. I don't like the angry woke Twitter mob when it comes at me. I don't like an angry Twitter mob when it goes after those people. I don't like it when it comes from the right, from the left, down the middle. I just don't like this sort of thing. I don't like the angry Twitter mob. I think it's a dangerous thing. This person then went on to post, the fact that a successful white, presumably liberal rock star dude and a bunch of his white, presumably liberal fans had very big feelings yesterday when I pointed out that he should maybe amplify more diverse voices on his podcast shows how deep white supremacy is rooted. Again, trying to link me and my show and my fans to white supremacy is a deeply, deeply offensive charge, and just factually baseless. So that leads me to where I started this whole thing, where I wanted to see, because I figured after this whole thing, you know, this person is clearly much more tied into LGBTQ community in Americana and country music than I am. And so I thought, you know, after all this kerfuffle on my Twitter feed, well, surely I will be getting a flood of pitches from publicists and managers, and maybe even directly from artists themselves, to come on the show. So, you know, most publicists in that I have a relationship with know how to reach me, have my personal email. I didn't get any pitches to my personal email. I checked with my buddy that used to help me book the show, because sometimes he gets the odd stray email still, from a publicist, and he hadn't gotten any pitches from anybody, period, much less anybody representing LGBTQ or BIPOC artists. So I thought, well, you know, maybe these pitches are coming to my Gmail account. So I went onto my Gmail account. By the way, this is Sunday morning that I'm recording this, and this whole thing happened, I think, midweek. So this is, what, 4 or 5 days since then. So I started sifting through my my Gmail Walking the Floor account, and I want to let you know that I have not received a single pitch, not one email from anybody that represents these marginalized communities that this person is claiming I'm not giving a fair shake to on my show. So I just want to make it clear that any PR person or manager worth their salt knows how to reach me, can figure out how to reach me. If you can't, you just go to walkingthefloor.com, hit contact. I'll look there. I promise. I'll look more often. And anybody out there can pitch me anybody they would like. And there are considerations that go into how I select guests, but I will continue to never discriminate against anybody along racial or gender or sexual identity, sexual preference, along any lines at all. And that's honestly the best that I can do. Anyway, ironically somewhat, I was been in contact earlier in the week with my guest today, who I'm sure you know and love, Mr. Waylon Payne, fantastic artist who has a great album out not too long ago, the end of last year, called Blue Eyes, The Harlot, The Queer, The Pusher, and Me. If you haven't listened to that album, you need to go listen to it right now. It's fantastic. One of the best releases of this past, you know, COVID time. He's fantastic. We had a great, great talk. I talked to him actually about all these subjects that I'm sitting here rambling about right now, because he, you know, he's an openly gay country music artist or Americana artist or however you want to classify him. And he had an interesting take on all this stuff. And we got kind of deep into it, as well as talking about his whole life and acting and music and, you know, where he came from and his whole journey. It's really great. All right, enough of me talking. I'll let him tell you himself. This is Waylon Payne on Walking the Floor.
Mama's been crying in the kitchen. Daddy's done left in the truck. He's headed down to the ABC store to get a little more fucked up.
Let's just jump in on this. I'm curious what your take is. Like, you've been around for a long time. You know, you've been making records and acting and whatever. And why do you think right now you finally seem like you're having this moment in the sun?
Man, I think that it's honestly because I'm together and I'm applying myself. I've never really done that before. I had my last record came out about 16 years ago, and I just got sidetracked shortly after signing that record deal, and got hooked up with somebody, and we started smoking speed, and it really led to the big crack, and that, and you know, my mom died right after that, and so I had never dealt with some shit that was from my past, you know, from my teenage years that had happened that was kind of traumatic, and you really have to deal with stuff, because if you try to put it in a box and stick it down somewhere, that doesn't work. And I didn't put two and two together. Oh, the reason you're trying to kill yourself is because you've got this shit that you never dealt with back here. And, you know,
yeah.
And literally it was just, that's what it was. I just was sidetracked. And about, 10 years ago, I changed my life and, started doing things different, and it was just a steady, you know what I mean? It's like, maybe it's just a relaying of the groundwork, because it feels like I've got that foundation that I should have had years ago, you know, which leads us to exactly what's going on with, you know, Morgan Wallen right now. You know, nobody will tell him no. Nobody will say, hey, you can't do this. Nobody cares enough about that boy to say, hey, you can't do this, because they're worried about their almighty, you know, dollar. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
I did think it was interesting, since you bring that up, and this is such a music biz, and I haven't followed it closely, so I don't know where this is all at, but it seemed like such a music biz response to be suspended from your label. Like, what exactly does that mean? Like, hey man, we're going to kind of sit quietly and see how this shit plays out before we really do anything here.
I mean, why start now? You know, I mean, why make this kid an example? You know, I mean, now listen, I'm not saying that it's not, you know, wrong place, wrong time, but that shit will bite you in the ass, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody should be talking about it, because it's like, you know, there's not really any room for hate in this business, but there's so much of it, it seems.
Oh, there is an awful lot of hate. And I was going to get to that eventually. I wanted to talk through some of like your life and your music and stuff, because I think that's more central to what we're doing here. But I myself have had a very interesting week. I mean, we can just talk about it now since we're on the subject, but, two, three days ago, wound up getting trolled by somebody making some accusations against me and my podcast about, you know, not being representative enough of artists of color and artists from the LGBTQ community. Right. And I pushed back on that, and it unleashed this wave of it was like the Twitter mob, the woke virtue signaling Twitter mob came after me really hard. And it's like, I'm used to being attacked from the right. You know, if I post that I'm playing at a Bernie Sanders rally or something, I'm used to
right-wing
voices calling me a fucking commie, or even more sort of centrist Democrats saying, hey man, that's dangerous. Don't do, you know, not this time, like that. I'm used to that kind of, those kinds of attacks. I'm not used to, and not to say that this woman that started this thing is the voice of the LGBT community, even though she probably thinks she is. I'm not used to being called on the carpet and shamed and blamed by communities that I think I stand in solidarity with. And the whole thing has been really hard to navigate, to be honest with you.
You know what? People are so ready to just go at each other's throats, period. You know, it's like, there is such a temperature in the nation right now because of a lot of things. I will say, I think that the last 4 years have had a lot to do with it. Because I think that there's just been a barrage of trash every day, 24 hours a day, coming at us for the past 4 years. Everybody's in PTSD. Everybody's in a little bit of shock, because people just don't act that way. you know?
Right.
But because we've been seeing it, it's made everybody really ready to just be on one side or the other. I've never seen it so polarized. It's really crazy.
I'm curious, you got called what?
I got called a racist yesterday on Twitter, you know, and I'm like,
oh no, can I read to you where this, what this escalated into on my Twitter feed? I was getting comments like, so your podcast guest lineup looks like a KKK meeting and you don't think it's important to include a little diversity. When did I say it's not important to have diversity?
Open your eyes, man. Like, what's going on? Like, everybody is, that's another thing, you know, I kind of will probably get in trouble for this. I don't know how many people watch your podcast, but I have a problem with some of this shit. You know, I'm gay. I'm a fucking gay man. I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to be cussing, but I'm
you
a gay man.
Cuss all you want, brother. Cuss all you want.
But it's like, don't tell me first of all, that I have to respect you or your organization for anything. That's not what I have to do. Now, you're owed a common amount of basic decency and common respect. You know what I mean? But don't come
Absolutely.
After me and you know me and thinking that you know what side I'm on when you haven't even fucking had a chance to ask me, you know?
Well, that's kind of one of the most amazing angles of this whole thing is that, you know, I don't agree with the criticism, and that's why I wanted to talk to you about it. I wanted to see, I mean, and I don't want to make your sexuality central to our conversation, but we're kind of going there. But I am curious, as a gay man and a gay country music artist, you know, what, in your opinion, is my responsibility as a podcast host?
Your responsibility.
Beyond, like you said, a basic respect and you know, to do no harm or however you want to, you know.
Well, let me ask you a question. Like, this is your podcast, right?
Right.
This is your show, right?
Correct.
So I don't expect anything from you other than topics that you find interesting or things that you find are interesting. You see? Nobody else has any right to tell you that either. You know, they just don't.
Well, here's the interesting thing, and I'm not going to pretend that, you know, look, I'm a white man of a certain age in a certain tax bracket, and I'm not going to pretend that my world view or life experience isn't colored by that. Of course it is. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm necessarily out front on the issues that, you know, people of color in our industry or LGBT community are face on a day-to-day basis. But you know, this woman, you might know her. She's an Apple Radio DJ. And I think she used to write for NPR or something there. It's like, people don't remember when they make these accusations that they have a digital paper trail as well. And so I just kind of looked her up and checked her out. I mean, first off, her initial sort of thing that she came at me on was, you know, out of your last 100 guests, you've only had four artists that are LGBTQ and two that are BIPOC. And just out of people of color. So just out of curiosity, because my first thought was, okay, I've never discriminated against anybody. I've never booked anybody, I've never not booked someone because they're gay. I've never booked anybody because they're gay.
Right.
It just doesn't come into it. And to be perfectly frank, dude, I try to avoid, this is like this time in the music industry that's so narrative driven. And having this podcast, I see the other side. I see the way we're all pitched by our publicists and our managers. And that becomes so central that it's all narrative driven. And people, that becomes very central to the story of how artists are pitched. And I actually, when I have interviewed SG Goodman or you know, Shelby Lynn or somebody, I kind of avoid that shit because I would rather just talk to the artist.
It's probably an okay thing to do it, you know.
But the critique was that out of my last 100 guests, only four were LGBT. Because I just Googled and I looked around, and I don't know if these numbers are correct, but I found this on a couple of different sources that roughly about 4% of the population identifies as LGBTQ, which just inadvertently puts my show exactly in line with society, which I didn't try to do, but I don't, like, does that mean I have to apologize to the world that I need to do better? I don't even get what the issue is.
My whole thought on it is maybe, and this is going to probably get me in trouble too. You know, you asked me why it was my moment in the sun a while ago, because my music's fucking good. And I've got a
exactly.
story, and I'm good at what I do. And maybe I was dedicated to it and it rose to the top. You know what? There are lots of great artists that rise to the top that happen to be gay as well. You know what I mean? And it's not really that big of a deal. I mean, it's never been a big deal for me. I've always, you know what I mean? I've always been gay. It's not, right. not anything that I've ever received shit for, or if I did, I didn't know it, you know? It's not how I operate my world. I don't have that kind of stuff in my life. It doesn't really matter, you know? It doesn't really matter. Although for some reason it matters as this record's come out a little bit, you know?
Right.
I think everybody should just be able to be who they are, you know? And if you need to have more gay, awesome artists on your show, well, then maybe we need to start making some more gay, awesome artists on, you know, that make great music. Maybe the reason you're not having people on just isn't because they're gay or they're straight. Maybe their music sucks, you know?
Well, it's funny because, I mean,
or maybe it's, you know, it's kind of rude for somebody to go and tell you how to run your show, I just think. But
I mean, what in your experience, if you don't mind me asking, are the areas in this industry? Because my I'm not really directly involved in sort of mainstream country music. You know, I kind of came to Americana through the side door of fucking punk rock and shit, you know. But so I don't really know what it's like in that industry. But in your experience, growing up around it, being the artist that you are, where is the institutional racism, racism and sexism and bigotry in general in the country music industry that you've experienced, or that you would say would be maybe where to push back on?
I mean, like, I don't ever think about that stuff. I mean, it's just not anything that fucking matters to me, you know?
Right.
I'm not here to be political. I'm not here to do anything other than speak out to what I think is right or wrong, you know? And then again, that's just my opinion. So if you're listening to that and thinking it rules the world, well, you've got a serious problem there in the first place. You should look inside your own head and see what your own thoughts are. You know what I mean? I think that everybody should just, if it could just get back to everybody respecting each other, just common respect, you know. If you don't like somebody, don't hang out with them. And don't be pissed off if somebody doesn't like you and doesn't want to hang out with you. Nobody has to hang out with you just because you're an artist, you know. And people aren't going to always welcome you. They don't always welcome me. That's okay. I've been at this for a long time. My people are Christofferson and Willie Nelson and Billy Joe Shaver and, you know, Jesse Coulter and... those are my people, you know, Shooter and Lucinda, and Elizabeth and Paula. And those are my people. And I don't have any problem in there, you know?
Listen, man, I appreciate you talking to me. I don't want to harp on too much about this, and that's not why.
Well, I'm sad that they hurt your feelings.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I can take the beating. It's just, you know, I don't know, man. You know this. You see this stuff happen all the time, and it finally happened to me a little bit, and then it sort of quieted down. And you just sit there and go, "Man, is this thing going to come back on me again?" I don't know, man. You know, I'm not, like I said, I'm not used to being attacked from the more progressive side of things, and it makes me admittedly defensive, but I'm defending myself against something that I don't think I'm guilty of. So anyway,
it's only the last 4 years that we've all become sinners and Satanists, you know.
I was a sinner long before that, Waylon. Long before that, baby.
I've been a sinner a long time. Suddenly, if you have that word that starts with a D in anywhere in your vernacular, you know, Democrats are evil and awful and I don't know when that started. Suddenly someone can attack me because they think I might be a Democrat, or they can attack me because I might not be Republican enough. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
I remember the days when we used to have presidential elections and we had a government. And when that election was over, everybody shook hands, moved on, and forgot about them for the next 4 years because they were doing their job and we were doing ours.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Worst thing to ever happen to the president.
That's for sure. Anyway, let's get back to your album, dude, because your album's amazing and a real wonderful work of art. And you already addressed the sort of the long gap between records. We can come back to some of that in a bit. But I am curious how this record came together, and I would love to hear you talk about recording at Monument. I read something about how you sang. You did your vocals in like literally the exact same spot that your mom did her vocals, singing with Kris Kristofferson or something.
Well, she, you know, she was a recording artist.
Sure.
And
for people that don't know, your family is like, you know, well known, you know, country music artist, Jody Payne and Sammy Smith. Yeah.
Mama recorded all of her records at Monument. And
oh, really?
And, yeah, I was there as a child. It was just part of it. That was where it went down. Help Me Make It Through the Night. She sang it there. She sang most of her hits there. And I sat in the same spot for that whole 2 week period we were there. And it was delicious. It was absolutely beautiful. And, I can't ask for more than that.
I mean, go ahead.
Go ahead. You ask.
Oh, I was going to say we recorded a song out there a few years ago. At Southern Ground, you know, Monument Studios, obviously, for people listening, is now Southern Ground. And I remember, I mean, it's a beautiful room, but I remember there were a ton of old master tapes still in there from back in the day. Like when you're in there recording, you look up and see your mom's master tapes up on the wall.
We looked for it. We couldn't find it, but we found all the records of her session dates there, and they've got all of those there. So, I had my eye out and a big bag with me in case I saw any.
I mean, obviously you knew the history of the place. Like, did you intentionally go there because of that, or did you?
Frank Liddell is like my surrogate father. He has taken care of me for many, many years. He's my publisher. He's my producer. And when I came back to Nashville in 2015 and we decided we wanted to do this record, I very, very much in passing had commented on my mom recorded all of her songs there. Wow, that'd be kind of neat to sing there, wouldn't it? Or, you know, and before I knew it, you know, he's like, oh, we start the record next week, show up. And I'm like, where? And he's like, Southern Ground. I'm like, oh, you know, I said, wouldn't it be nice to, well, it sure would be nice to have some strings like my mama had. And then the next thing I know, I've got strings that are just gorgeous. Frank, did you
do those at Southern Ground? Mm-hmm. Like, are those actual strings or is that in, you know, the box?
That's an actual orchestra. That's Christian Wilkerson. And she played on one of my mom's albums back in the 80s, you know.
Really?
Crazy. Oh, yeah. It was just heaven. It was heaven, the whole thing. The whole thing was just a, you know, I moved away from here in 2008 and I was really, really bad off on methamphetamines. I was injecting and smoking and just doing all sorts of bad stuff. And I got to Texas for a series of dates and I met a buddy of mine that's my best friend now named Edward. And Edward, I don't know what he saw in me or why he decided to take me under his wing. But he just became my best friend and he just expected something of me. Somebody finally expected something of me. And I slowly started putting my life back together. And before I knew it, he had a baby boy and that baby boy knew who I was. And I was like he was like my child. And I just knew that, this was a special child. This was special. This was a gift from God that I was looking at, being able to see this image of a father and a son, how it was supposed to be. And so I got sober on his first birthday and never looked back. And he's almost 10 now. And it's just And I started writing these songs, you know, because once I got off the drugs, you know, there's a great organization down in Austin called HAM, the Health Alliance for Austin Musicians, and they help you get mental help if you need it in psychotherapy, and they help you get your health situated and insurance, and you know what I mean. And so once I put the meth down, I couldn't not deal with it because it was right there in my face. And so it took some time, but man, I just dove in and started making changes. And then before I knew it, I had these songs, and I went back to Nashville, and Frank gave me my old job back and said, yeah, let's make this better. And then we did. And you know, it's been an incredible ride, the journey to get to this song, these albums, this album.
You said that you, in seeing your friend have his son, you said, you just, I forget exactly how you put it, but you said how a father and son's relationship should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was what you said. I mean, is that a reflection of your own?
I had terrible father figures. I didn't know my father till I was about 16. I was raised with my aunt and uncle. My uncle was a mean guy. He was just not a good guy, and was very hard on me. You know, you're not going to be a sissy. You're not going to be a sissy. But then, you know, around 14, his attitude changed into something demonstrative, and it tore my family apart. And so, I've never had good experiences with fathers. Now, then I started hanging out with my dad around 18 or 19, and because of what had happened with my uncle, we couldn't deal with it, you know.
And how come up to that point you hadn't lived or hadn't known your dad?
Well, my dad played for Willie Nelson and did a lot of speed, did a lot of drugs. My mama would not have me be around him.
Okay.
No. They went through a very bitter breakup, and she didn't like him, and he didn't like her. And when I started hanging out with him, she didn't like it. And when I started hanging in, and he didn't like the way I reminded him of her, you know, it was just a bunch of
things. Yeah. Family can be fucked up.
Family's scarable. And so it was the first time that I'd seen this huge man just fucking fall in love with this baby. And he was a father, and he was not only a father to Lake. He had been a father to me for years before Lake even came along. Gently and tenderly and lovingly and firmly making me realize I needed to pull my shit together. You know, I was Morgan Wallen. I didn't care.
Were you writing these songs through that time while you were sort of working your way through all this?
When I put this stuff down, yeah, they started coming after I met Edward and when Lake came along, yeah.
Because this album sounds like a dude working through some shit, you know what I mean? Like, that comes out in the tone of your voice, even.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's real, dude. It's like, you know what I mean? This is nobody's story but mine. And it you know, I mean, I'm glad that this album is here, because it feels like my very first album, anyway.
Right. Right.
I can't even really remember The Drifter and that kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
I don't really ever sing those songs. These songs I'm okay with singing, you know?
I mean, you talked about not really growing up with your dad, but I know he was a songwriter. Did you take influence from him as a writer? Did you eventually sort of, like, did he ever give you Pearl's Wisdom, or your mom, you know, either of them?
My mother did, yeah. Mother did. My heroes were Bobby Gentry and Kris Kristofferson. And Willie, that's where I got my knowledge. I played my songs for Willie and I would get my opinions. I would play my
really?
Songs. Oh yeah. I'd play my songs for Shelby Lynn. Shelby Lynn was the one who taught me how to tap into that about my writing. And she was the first one to encourage me to write. And she healed the relationship between me and my mom after everything had fallen apart through songs and through my songs. So my mother was my biggest fan. My mother, I trusted her, and she trusted me, and she told me that I was a very personal writer, and I never needed to change it because nobody did that. And I learned from Bobby Gentry and Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson, and that's what I learned from.
Did you literally get, like, pearls of wisdom from, like, Christofferson.
Because
Waylon and these guys.
When my family threw me out when I was 18, right? Because I came out as gay and I told on what had been going on with this over here. They disowned me, and that included my mom for a while. And so I looked up my dad, who was on the road with Willie. And when I was 18, I started going on the road with Willie and my dad. And so Willie's like a dad to me. Yeah. I mean, I grew up on the road with them. And that's how I learned how to be a songwriter. That's how I learned how to do what I do. And I learned from the best. Yeah, Christopher.
Do you remember any specific advice any of those folks gave you?
Well, I mean, I sang a song one night and Christofferson stood up and told the room to shut the hell up because that was a song that they had just witnessed and they needed to pay attention to it. When I went through a particular situation with not trusting myself in a situation on writing and it turned around and bit me in the ass, Willie was right there going, "Hey, listen, you learned. Now, next time, don't." You know, they were like my folks. They were like right. They were my heroes. It was an education that was good.
Since we're on the subject, can you get into the sort of nuts and bolts of your songwriting? I know you've written a lot on, you know, for other artists as well. And I didn't know if you had spent some time as like a Music Row kind of world songwriter.
What do you mean?
Well, like, can you get into that? I'm always curious with songwriters, like really like what they do. And I know it's a bit of a tough question because nobody can ever seem to really answer it. But like, you know, do you answer all your mail and sit down at your desk and get your fucking cup of coffee? You know, like what is how do you do it?
Well, I mean, they just come. My songs just come, you know. Since 2015, when I came back to Nashville, I've written probably 250, 300 songs. Either by myself or co-write, you know, with people. So for a while, when I got back here in 2015, when Frank gave me my job back, I was just like, you know, hey, yeah, I'll write. And so that's what I did. You know, they would hook up for me to write, and that's what I would do. And, but as far as these things, you know, they just come to me. They just come to me as they come to me, you know, and they usually always come just at the same time. You know, it's almost like I feel, and I've said it before, I don't know that I can take credit for these because I just feel like I tap into something, you know.
Yeah.
None of us are saying anything that nobody's ever said before. None of us have original thoughts. We just can maybe figure out different ways to say it. I just trust myself. I can never speak really good when I'm talking in front of people, but when I'm singing to people, I can, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and I could say things to you in a song that may not hit you for 5 years, you know? And then one day you'll turn around and go, wait a minute. Oh, holy shit. Has he been saying that this whole time? Yeah, but it was just non-threatening, you know? I guess, I don't know. I don't have the secret to any of it. I just am a dude who is lucky enough to get paid to sing songs, and somebody is taking the time to hear them. You know, Frank really digs my songs, and so.
Well, I'm interested because, you know, I've written with a few different writers out in Nashville over the years, and I've noticed like some, you know, I've never gotten like a cut by a mainstream country artist or anything close to that. I'm more just sort of write with people for my own stuff, and I tend to like you referenced. Want to write like things that are just personal to me versus the sort of like, you know, well-crafted hook play on words thing that is also kind of prevalent. Do you get pushback from people like, this is too personal. This is too, you know, this is too much your own story. Nobody's going to relate to this. You know, we can't pitch this or any of that kind of stuff or is.
No.
Great.
Write my songs.
Yeah.
You know, my songs, I try real hard to put something in them, you know. I mean, they wouldn't be coming if they weren't supposed to be here, you know. But I could spend every day trying to write crap, you know, and but that wouldn't work too good.
Yeah.
You know? And my songs are really personal, so I wouldn't expect everybody to get them. But the people that need to get them are getting them. And that's something pretty powerful. These feelings that I have that are all mine, nobody else's. I was able to channel them out of me and tell some stories. And those are the ones that are hitting home. This album's hitting home because it might mean something. I'm not, you know what I mean? I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It just might, it means something. This record's important. And I get letters a lot these days from people, boys and girls, both, you know. Some are gay, some are not. Some are drug addicts, some are not. Some are sex abuse survivors, some are not. Some have problems I'll never comprehend. And, you know, I'm from the old school. My heroes, you know, feeling so lonely, crazy for feeling so blue. That's a real fucking feeling that came out of a real man, like a man. That man came into my house and put his knee up on the thing and said, you know what? We can kick you out of here if you don't pull your shit together. You know, don't look so sad. I know it's over. Lay your head upon my pillow. That came from a real man. And that man is who I modeled my life after, Mr. Christofferson. And Mr. Christofferson will tell you any day of the week. You know what I mean? He that's real stuff. I don't hear much real stuff that makes me feel these days.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's why we're not on mainstream radio. That's okay. There's somebody.
Where do you sit in these sort of.
Not me.
Well, where do you get support? You know, I guess like
they're playing me, thank God, on Americana, which is great. You know,
yeah.
I'll take it. Sure. And the internet's an amazing thing. You know, people, I mean, like who has genres anymore? Really?
Right.
You know,
right.
It's just those idiots fucking at record labels that are trying to hold on to that game plan that are the losers. You know, they end up having shit happen like happened this weekend. When you know, this music, does it really mean anything? Are we going to lose it if it goes away? You know, or do we need something else that might speak to us? I fell into a burning ring of fire. June Carter was having an affair with a married man when she wrote that. That's real shit.
Yeah.
You know, I just want real.
Yeah.
And so we did something real, or at least we tried to, and there it is.
It's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing. And obviously, like, you know, like you said, that's I think why your record is resonating so big with so many people. It's refreshing.
Man, you know, I mean, I'm just a singer and a songwriter, and there are lots of us out there. It just maybe sometimes the cream does rise to the top if it's given a chance. And that takes everybody pulling their weight, you know. The Drifter may have been an incredible album, but I was not pulling my weight, so the rest of the group suffered.
Mm.
Maybe the reason this is working is because we're all in our right minds, and we're all on a team. And
yeah, I think for people out there, listen, there is a I think a bit of naivety about how this business works in that regard with. How important your team is, how many people stand between an artist recording a song and anybody ever hearing it, much less getting on a playlist or getting, you know, on the good press coverage or any of that stuff. There's a lot of people between those two points, you know?
Yeah.
You just mentioned The Drifter, your first record, and I'm curious how you wound up in LA, because I read that you were part of that Eastbound and Down.
I was, yeah.
At the King. When was that? Like the 90s? That was like Keith Gaddis and my man Mitch Marine and some of those folks?
2002.
Oh, okay.
I had ended up in LA because I was working with Shelby Lynn. And I was a bit of a drinker and a partier, and I got fired out there. And so I just kind of stayed. I had some friends that happened to be out there that had moved from Nashville. And then I ran into Keith Gaddis, who happened to live there from Nashville. And we started playing music together, and he just took interest in my stuff and took time away from his busy schedule of producing his own records to produce me. And he just believed in it and took a risk.
And did you guys play together at the Eastbound Down thing? Were you guys?
Oh yeah, it was me and Travis Howard and Keith Gaddis.
Travis Howard. I love Travis Howard. Yeah, he's fantastic.
Austin Hanks was there too.
That's interesting. I mean, for people listening that aren't familiar with Keith Gaddis, you know, he went on to become a very successful songwriter and producer and you know, solo artist in his own right, and played with Dwight Yoakam. And I'm just curious what that scene, because, you know, I didn't live in LA at that time. I lived here prior to that and moved back after that time period. And so I missed that whole scene. But, you know, you don't think of LA nowadays as being much of a hotbed for country music. But there was this thriving thing happening at the King King that was, like, you know, a bit after all the Palomino cowpunk thing that happened.
We did our own thing there. We were all very, very good at what we did. And we had all basically just come from Nashville, and we had made a rule that there would be nothing past 1986, maybe, or 82 or something like that, and everything before it was free game, and we just rocked our asses off. And I mean, it was a club, the King King, hold maybe what, 400 people, maybe. We'd have 1,000 packed in that little fucker.
Really?
Vince Vaughn would be drunk, fucking handing me bourbon, and I'd be trying to kiss him because he's cute. He'd be, no.
Imagine having 1,000 people in a 400 capacity club now in COVID. It's unthinkable.
It was the wildest night in Hollywood. We had a good Joey Lauren Adams. You remember her? She's an actress, and she was dating Travis at the time, and she put that together with us. And man, it was standing room only. And it was one of the most legendary shows in Hollywood. And we only did 4 of them.
Oh, are you kidding me? No. I thought it was like a long running thing, that kind of scene shows that happened. Really? I mean, was that time? Like, I know you were already a musician and everything, but is that sort of how you got into acting, just from being out here? Were you already doing that?
I was in Hollywood. The record was about to come out, and my agent at the time had said, "Hey, they're auditioning people for this Johnny Cash film. They want real musicians to play real musicians." So I just went on a cold call, and I got it, you know. And it was changed my life. That led to a lot of other things too. That was just me bullshitting my way through it.
That's amazing, man. I mean, did you sort of after the fact take acting lessons? Like, is that something you still pursue now?
I do. It's a secondary form of income for me. I'm equally an actor as much as I am a songwriter. But it's not anything that I ever took classes for. Matter of fact, I had looked into it, and I was working on a film with the director, Monty Hellman, who's classic. And I respect him more than anything in the world. And I said, "Well, I'm kind of thinking about, you know, studying some acting." He's like, "No, don't fucking do that. Just go with your gut. You are fine." So it would be like Christofferson telling me, "No, don't fucking do anything. That song's great. Okay. I've been told by the master, I'm fine."
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Well, hey man, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit here and talk with me. It's been a lot of fun and enlightening. And you know, I know it took 16 years between your last records. Something tells me it's not going to take that long between. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see what you do, and I can't, you know, I've never gotten to see you play live. So I'm looking forward to that when this all comes out. For sure, dude. Thank you. Yes, yes, yes. That was Waylon Payne on Walking the Floor. Make sure you go check his latest record out. It's fantastic. Alrighty, thank you for tuning in. That's it for this week, and we'll see you when we see you. Adios, amigos!
Well, at first it was beer, and then it was whiskey, and then it was coke, and then speed.